David Tennant does a podcast with
Gordon Brown.
So, Gordon, thank you for being here. I do appreciate it.
Well, it's great to be here, and it's great to see you again and to talk to you.
We are both sons of the manse.
Yes.
Both, our fathers were both ministers of the Church of Scotland. And when I was growing up, lots of people asked me whether I had ambition to follow in my father's footsteps. I don't know if that was something that, maybe there's a tradition of that in Church of Scotland families.
I don't think that was ever going to be for me.
You were never going to wear a
dog collar. My two brothers.
No.
And funnily enough, I don't think my father, I don't know about your father, my father never really encouraged me or suggested that this would be the way forward. I think there was a time in the 1920s, 1930s when for a family, because my father's family came from farming stock, that to either be a teacher or a minister or a lawyer was the way out. Mm. And the way forward. And so, you know, there was a lawyer, there was a professor, so my father was a minister, but I never thought that was going to be for me. And also, of course, religion and politics are very difficult. So if you're doing, my father used to have this story about one of his friends. So he couldn't say to his congregation, the people that he was preaching to every Sunday, vote Labour or vote that. And so you could tell by the hymns that they chose, what to do. So if Labour won the election, it would be, "Now thank we all our God." If Labour lost, it would be, "Dear Lord and Father of mankind, forgive our foolish way." And if some third party won, it was, "Oh, God works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform." So, the thing about religion is that there were so many people in the church, in the congregation. Some were Tories, some were liberals, some were Labour. You had to be very careful.
Yeah.
So my father was always very conscious of that. I don't know if that was the same with you.
I think my father's politics probably were slightly changed a bit through his life. But your dad was always a Labour man, was he?
I don't know, actually, because one of the things is you didn't really... they always said to you, "Your vote's secret." I mean, remember that they grew up in an atmosphere where the vote was won in the sort of 1918 for women. 1928 was the first time that women had the vote. And I think they always prided themselves on the fact that the vote was secret. I mean, I knew where my father was voting, but he didn't go around telling people.
Right.
I don't think his congregation would know.
No.
He was very careful. So I always said he was too careful. He should have been more upfront. But anyway, I understand now.
But did you have political discussions at home? Was it
no, there was political discussions, but I mean, I wanted to be a footballer.
Are you sure?
I was growing up in Kirkcaldy, and I was playing football for the school, but I was playing football for the boys' brigade, and then I was playing rugby at school. But I always thought, originally, that my great ambition would be a footballer. Then, if you can't be a footballer, you want to be a football manager,
uh-huh.
a bit like the Roy of the Rovers, you know. And then you want to be a football owner if you can. Yeah. You can't be the manager. And so I've ended up with 5,000 shares in Raith Rovers, my local team.
Oh, you do have some?
Yeah, but that's sort of charity. you lose the money the minute you give it.
But was there a point where you could have been a footballer? Were you good enough?
No, I don't think so. I actually was probably better at rugby in the end. But
right.
I played a lot of rugby for my school. And then I got injured. I got this eye injury when I was only 16, and I lost the sight of one eye playing rugby.
Sure.
And so I was then banned sine die, if you like, from from sports. But, you know, I still can run and swim and all that sort of thing. But rugby was certainly out by then.
Did that feel like a big loss in your life?
It was, actually. It was.
I don't mean, obviously, the loss of your sight is one thing, but the loss of sport or something.
Yeah. It changes you. And so there are turning points in your life. And so I actually, for a variety of reasons, went to university at 16. I arrived the first day I was at university. I then had an appointment to see an eye surgeon. I went to see the eye surgeon, and I was in hospital, and I was being operated on the day that I should have been starting my university course.
Right.
And I spent the first 3 months, really, out of action because I was in hospital. And then the same thing happened again. I had to have another operation. Then the same thing happened again, and I was off, really, for a lot of my first year and a half at university.
Mm.
More than that, actually. And so... it rather dominated my life for a while, trying to save my sight, because then it happened in the second eye, and I really thought at that stage I was going to lose my sight, because they'd failed with three operations on the first eye. So they tried the second eye, and you think it's not going to work either, but it did. And I was at the cusp of this new technology, and only 20% of these retina operations, because it was detached retina, succeeded in the time I was being operated on. So I was a very lucky person. Now it's 90%.
Right.
But 20% then. And they were using all the old technology. And, you know, there was probably no chance of saving the sight my first eye. But I got this brilliant surgeon who'd been trained in Chicago in all the modern retina techniques. And he came back and I was virtually one of his first patients. And he saved my sight.
Yeah.
And so I was very lucky. But it did dominate two or three years. So I was all sport.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you think, well, what are you going to do with your life? So you got to do something different.
Did you suddenly, that's quite a big thing to go through at 16 when you feel like your life is all potential. Did you suddenly feel a little bit more mortal than most 16 years?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And the funny thing is you've got an eye problem and you're losing the sight in an eye, but the rest of your body's fine. So you're not so unfit that you're not aware that you could have been doing other things. And it's quite a distraction. But, you know, the when the final operation was done, I was in my fourth year. So I'd been having regular sort of hospital appointments. And when it worked, it was amazing because I really had not expected it to work. I really did think I was going blind. In fact, for some time, I was getting all this thing from the Royal National Institute for the Blind, the talking book service, because, you know, there was an assumption that these operations didn't work.
Now, I was reading your because you've written about your time in office recently, which you resisted for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I don't like looking back. I'll be honest. And I think it's more uncomfortable things to have to do, because you've got to admit your mistakes, which of course is a good thing in many ways, that you have got to face up to them. But it's not the best thing. It's not the most exciting. It's not the most enjoyable thing to do.
But there's something you recount a day. You were Prime Minister in September 2009. And you woke up one day and you found that the vision in your good eye had badly deteriorated.
Yeah,
and you worried that it was going to go completely.
Yeah, I thought I'd detach my retina again, and I thought this is it. And I went to the Moorfields Hospital, which is...
No, but before you did that, and this is the bit that I find extraordinary, before you did that, you kept a speaking engagement
in Hackney.
I did,
but then I couldn't see anything.
But that's the bit. Why do you not kind of go... Okay, cancel the day. I'm going to hospital
because
right
now. I'd made a commitment to do this school opening, and I...
But I'm sure they'd have understood.
They might have understood, but I did it, and then I went to the hospital. Yeah.
and you had notes that you discarded because you couldn't see them, but you didn't want anyone to know.
No, I didn't want anybody to know, and so you just keep going, and I went to the school, did the visit. They may have thought that I was talking nonsense. I don't know, but I then went to the hospital.
But I think that says something extraordinary about you. It's either something wonderful or something bonkers. I'm not sure which it is, because that shows incredible sort of...
I think it was a sense of obligation that I promised to do this, and I knew I could do this, and then I could go to the hospital. But it was very early in the morning, so I think it probably was 9 o'clock.
But are you not, as a human being, are you not beginning to panic? There's something you've sort of feared all your life is sort of occurring.
Yeah, a bit. But you got to keep going as well. And, you know, we made an appointment to go to the hospital. I then arrived at the hospital and then got seen. Then he told me that I had actually detached my retina and it was really needing an operation. And I arranged to go on a few days later to get this operation. Mm. So it was a bit strange.
Yeah, and all
but,
that.
But, you know, duty. You've got to do the things you promised to do, and I think we did it. And then, you know, I didn't lose much time.
So do you have an ability to compartmentalise? Are you able to kind of go, this is happening, this is very real, and this is a very vivid thing which has to be dealt with. But right now I'm doing a speech in Hackney.
I think we all have this ability to compartmentalise, as you put it. I mean, you know, you put one thing to a side when you've got to get on with something else. And in the job I was in, you've got to be able to concentrate on the issues that you're dealing with, the things that are at hand. And if you allow yourself to be diverted too much, then you actually lose the ability to make good judgments. Maybe people thought I didn't make any good judgments anyway, but you lose the ability if your focus is not on the issue at hand.
I absolutely agree with you, but I think it's easier said than done. I mean, I commend your ability to do it. Do you think you got that from, is that a work ethic? Is that from your parents?
I think both my parents had a very strong sense of duty. I think probably you were brought up with the same, and in Scotland it's very much a trait that certainly came through the church, through religion, that you've got obligations to other people. You've got to get on with it, and you don't complain. You just get on with it.
Yes, I think most. I think a lot.
I think
more
you decided I was mad that day.
No, I didn't.
I think I was just carrying out.
I think it's extraordinary. I think it's brilliant that you were able to do that. I just think I'd have panicked.
Yeah, there's certain things where you would, I think, but I knew I was going to see it, get an appointment very soon after.
Mm. You became Chancellor in 1997.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you just not long before your father passed away?
Yeah.
What did he make of that?
He passed away only really just a year after I became Chancellor. Mm. And I didn't really, this is the problem of being in a job like being Chancellor. I didn't really have time to go and see him as much as I wanted to or to listen to him. I spoke to him the night before he died and just didn't realise that he was not well. And I was rushing between meetings, and I've always felt very bad at this. So one of the things about a job that is all-consuming, like being the head of the Treasury and having to go to international meetings and having to prepare budgets and everything else, it does cost a lot in terms of your family time, and so that was a difficult time because you feel very bad that he wanted to talk that evening, and I just didn't have the time, or I didn't feel I had the time, and of course I should have made the time.
Well, was he demonstrative in his pride, or was that not how
that's you
did?
You must not. You're Scottish.
Well,
you're Scottish. You must know
what the answer might be.
You must not. You never talk yourself up. But always, always be modest. And I mean, it's not humility in how I achieved it. No, but it's a bit of you're heading for a fall if you start to be too arrogant or start to walk around as if you own the world.
What about your mum? Was she?
My mother was even quieter about this. I think she was less. They'd had some bad experiences with the press, actually, because my mother, some of the newspapers, I mean, at that time, and they probably still do, they phoned up my father and my mother, you know, just out of the blue and just asked them questions. And my parents were too courteous and too nice to put the phone down.
My father was exactly the same. Yeah. I'm sure you got it on a much bigger scale than I did.
I don't think so. I think you would have had it big, but and then they would come to the door of the house, and my parents, instead of chasing them away, would let them in and offer them coffee
give
and
them a
tea.
Cup of tea.
Exactly.
Yes, I had exactly
and
the
then,
same.
And they would say, Gordon has said this, and my mother would say something. I don't know why he's saying these things. And so mother condemns Chancellor.
So
these things were sort of sent to try us, and it was not naivety on their part. It was just that they were taught to be courteous to everybody, and even the most aggressive newspaper reporter was given a welcome, which of course that reporter probably didn't expect, and then exploited.
Yeah. There's a great quote that your father came across. Be grateful for what you have. It's remarkable what you can do without.
Exactly. And I keep saying that to my children.
And presumably they listen to you as much as you listen to him.
I don't know. But it was one of his key phrases. Because you must know, we were brought up, we didn't have much money. Ministers and church were pretty badly paid. You had a house, but you couldn't afford to heat it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they gave the house for the job.
Yeah.
And they were usually big houses with lots of
crawl
room.
Exactly that, yeah.
And so we were brought up not to expect great sort of consumer possessions at Christmas or at birthdays or anything else. Mm. So, and he would say that he had managed to get by in a world where his father was even poorer. So I was brought up to be taught to be sort of grateful for what I had, yes.
You must have had ambition to aspire to the top job in the land, but ambition, I'm imagining, it was something of a dirty word in a Scottish Presbyterian household.
Duty, obligation.
Duty, that's the way you spin it.
But that's almost certainly true. Well, you know, when ministers apply or get offered a job in Scotland, it's because they've been called, they've been summoned. So it's not their ambition; it's someone else bringing them on. But I wanted, I was really interested in sport. Then I was probably going to be a university or a lecturer or something like that, because I did that for a bit. And then I got the chance to stand for... I tell this story then, it's absolutely true that when I... The first time I was asked to stand for an elected office was for the Edinburgh City Council, for the Edinburgh Town Council. And I was a student then. And of course, they were looking for candidates. And this guy comes to me and says, would you like to stand for the council? And I said, I don't know much about council taxes and council affairs. And I keep saying that probably I never did, even when I was chancellor, know much about council taxes. And I said, I don't know whether I can do that. It would be very difficult, sitting on the council when I'm so young. And he said, look, Paul, he said, if we were going to win this seat, you wouldn't be the candidate. He put me in my place. And that was an early lesson.
And did you?
I didn't stand for that, but I did. I became the rector of Edinburgh University because we found the students could elect the rector to chair the university course. Right. So I did that for a bit. And then I became a candidate. I was a candidate in South Edinburgh where I'd been a student. And didn't win the seat. And then I was chosen for my home area, which is Fife, in 1983. So, there was a sort of...
Yeah.
And then I arrived in Parliament. And given we're talking on the microphones, I made an almost fatal mistake. I arrived in Parliament and this guy, Gerald Coffin, you may remember, sure. He was our foreign affairs spokesman. And this was 1983, 1984. And he liked to go out to the theatre in the evenings, and he liked to go to the opera, and he liked to go to the films and everything else. And so Tony Blair and I were around then. And so he used to ask us to deputise for him in any interviews he wanted to do. And there was this one night he comes to me and said, I'm going out to the theatre. He said, I promised to do an interview, which I really regret now, but I've promised to do it. And would you stand in? It's a radio station down under. Would you just go there into my office at 10 o'clock? They'll phone through. And they'll do the interview. And so I went to his office at 10 o'clock. The telephone rang. I got this guy on the end of the phone. I said, can you tell me more about this? He said, no, we're going straight through to the studio. And the guy comes to me and said, Mr. Brown, he said, you represent the Labour Party in Britain. Down here, we've got a Labour Party that's very stuck in the mud. Have you got any advice for them? And I was able to name drop and said, I've just met your Prime Minister, Bob Hawke, and met people from the Australian Labour Party. They're doing really well. I said, Mr. Brown, he said, this is Radio Auckland. You're speaking to the people of New Zealand.
Oh!
And our Prime Minister is David Longy and not Bob Hawke. And what could I say? I had to act as if I never even said these words. It was so embarrassing. My first big interview, foreign affairs, talking to the world, and I got the country wrong. Just incredible. And I'll never forget that. And I thought my career was over.
So as you went through these milestones, elected to Parliament, and then part of the shadow cabinet, and then Chancellor of the Exchequer, were you able, and then, of course, Prime Minister, were you able to enjoy these milestones, or did it feel like...
Well, I was long enough an MP before I became a minister. So I came in 1983. I was an MP for 14 years before we were in government, because this was this long period of Labour opposition.
Sure.
Michael Foote, and then Neil Kinnock, and then John Smith, and then Tony. And we had these long years when you were a constituency MP. And one of the things I miss, actually, is being a member of Parliament for my home area,
right,
and representing people, because you learn so much from what people come and tell you and what people ask you to do. I mean, you do get lots of people asking you to do ridiculous things, but you do learn so much from doing that. So I actually enjoyed being a constituency MP, and that was a real privilege. And I did that, obviously. But when you're a government minister, you've got to concentrate on being a minister. So that was an enjoyable period, but it was a difficult period because we kept losing elections.
Yes. But then in 1997, were you able to enjoy that moment? Did it feel like a brave new world?
No, the moment was difficult because I'd already decided that if we won, the next day I would make the Bank of England independent.
Right.
And we'd already promised that we'd do a budget immediately, and we were going to do this big programme for youth unemployment to tackle it. And we were going to create this new deal, and we're going to have a windfall tax on the privatised, on the gas and the electricity and the telecom companies to pay for it. So we had this huge set of issues that we had to deal with almost instantaneously.
Yeah.
So I arrived, I think, down in London at sort of, I don't know, 3-4 o'clock in the morning or something, went to the event where people were celebrating, stayed for a few minutes and then left. And I was in the Treasury immediately the next day to try and make the Bank of England independent.
Right. But it's interesting you talk about that relentlessness. I mean, it must, a job like that must, do you sense that life goes on hold for?
I think politicians have got a shelf life. And I've come to realise this. There may be no accident why in America, you know, people go after 8 years. Mm. And I think after six in America, the public are pretty bored with the president,
right,
and are looking for a change. And I think because of this constant media attention, because of the 24-hour sort of clock, that, you know, every minute of the day you could be getting questions. The thing about now is that if anything's happening, people are not as interested in what the minister is saying. They're interested in what the number 10 is saying.
Right,
you know, and you
right.
know, I remember being asked about plots in Coronation Street. What was my view on that?
Right.
And you always had to have a view on a sports fixture, and you know, everything came back to you, and therefore, there's only a limited amount of time I think the public will tolerate you. I think they get fed up with people pretty quickly. I think there's almost overexposure because, by its very nature, the Prime Minister's in the firing line all the time. And so I think 6 years, 8 years, I mean, is too much. I think, you know, I was 10 years as Chancellor and then 3 years as Prime Minister. I think the public probably feel that the shelf life of a politician at the top in these top jobs is probably half that, maybe 6 years or so. And I don't see many politicians surviving for long periods of time in the way that people did in the 19th century. In the way, even, I mean, Tony was in for 10 years and Margaret Thatcher was in for 11, was it?
And yeah.
I don't see many surviving that sort of time in future.
And what's the personal cost to you of that? Because you're so... it's such a public existence.
Well, it's difficult because, when you've got kids, obviously, because you're trying to protect them from the glare of publicity. And so our kids grew up for the first year, a few years, in Downing Street itself. And it's a pretty strange atmosphere because Downing Street, you see this door, but behind it is an office. It's not really a house. It's an office.
Right.
And there's all these, well, you've been inside Downing Street and you've seen it, but you've got all these people, maybe 100 people working behind that door in different offices, and they're working in corridors. I mean, the whole place is falling down, let's be honest.
Right.
I mean, everybody admits it after they leave.
Right.
And everybody is asked when they come into the job, look, this place needs modernised. It needs to be completely gutted from top to bottom if it's going to survive for another century. And would you leave and go to Admiralty House, which is a place down the road, or go to some other building for a year or two? And usually they say it'll take 3 or 4 years. And you say no, because to be in number 10 is what people think a prime minister has got to be. You know, he's got to be there. And so you say, no, postpone it.
Yeah.
So this modernisation will never take place because... my successors will all also feel the same way. You don't know how long you're going to be in there. Why give up 3 or 4 years that you might be able to be working there for a modernization that you're not even going to benefit from, or that, you know, is going to lose you the use of what is the most famous building for at least the political decision making in Britain and perhaps in Europe. And so you want to stay in the building, but you, as people may know now, the Prime Minister actually works in number 10 and lives in number 11. The Chancellor of the Exchequer works in number 11 and lives in number 10. Very complicated set of arrangements. And these are flats. So kids are growing up in that sense. And you want to protect them from the glare of publicity.
Do they have very vivid memories of Downing Street?
No, I don't think they do now, because so much has happened since. So they were quite young when they left. But obviously they see the photographs, and that's more likely to bring their memories back. And of course, it was very difficult because, as you know, we had a daughter who died after 10 days, and that was a very difficult period because you want to be as far away from the public arena as possible, and it's just you can't do that.
Yes, when something like that happens, it's obviously so deeply personal. You must crave anonymity in a moment like that.
Yes, and also you know, it's you never want to be sitting with a child who's dying, who's your own child, but any child who's dying, and it makes you so aware of parents everywhere around the world, you know, and just, you know, my interest in helping children really is sort of magnified by everything that happened to us, and you never want to see an innocent or vulnerable child suffer again. You know, it's one of these things that just eats into you, and you want all the time to be doing something to make life better, at least for those people who are those children who can get through.
Do you think it changed the experience with Jennifer? Did that change how you did politics after that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't want to go back into politics after that happened. I wanted to stay away. Right. But once I went back, I was determined that, you know, we'd do something to tackle the problems that children faced. I mean, you know, it did inspire me to do more on the health service. It did make me feel more about the need to do something about child poverty. And of course, when you see all these needless deaths in other parts of the world, in poorer countries, deaths that can be avoided because of simply malnutrition or it's lack of health care or just lack of money for food, you really want to do something about it. So it made me more aware that we had to do more about the needs of children. And you, I can't bear to see a child crying through being neglected or through suffering from some sort of illness. And I mean, there's a part of you when you see it that is angry that this should be allowed to happen. You've got innocent children who are being hurt, but there's another part that is simply compassion. You want to do something about it to just help these children. So it definitely had a huge effect on both Sarah and me, and we set up a foundation to raise money, because there was this area of research into premature births had not really advanced much, surprisingly, of course, since there's so much great technology in the health service. And so one of the things that Sarah's been able to do is to help that research on. And it's amazing what they've been able to do to help children, not just in Britain, but help children in other countries. I mean, there's very straightforward things that are now being done, I think, that weren't being done 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Do you see... is Sarah very much a partner? And I mean, she was with you. You were married, yeah, while you were Chancellor, and
yes,
obviously you moved into Downing Street together. Is she? What's her role in your life at that time? I mean, is she a sounding board? Are you?
Well, Sarah's very good. She's not trying to interfere in politics, but I think her advice about some of the issues that we're dealing with, particularly on women's issues and women's equality, has been very sound and very, very helpful. And I think she's got a determination and resilience that we both needed when we're under attack from the press. I mean, it's funny, but you look back and you remember just how much these personal attacks by the press were wounding and difficult to bear, because not because you were so distressed yourself, but the time it took to have to deal with them. You were getting all these sort of, I mean, you know, The Sun, for example, said I'd fallen asleep at the Festival of Remembrance. Mm. And that was a big story, because it was like I was... you know, being discourteous to the troops and to people who had families of people who had died. And it just wasn't true. Mm. They had taken a photograph when there was a prayer and said I'd fallen asleep. The Sun also said that I hadn't bowed at the cenotaph. And it's just a complete lie. Mm. But you could take a photograph of me standing erect and say, well, he's not bowing at that point. But they didn't take the photograph, sure, when I was bowing. So yeah, these things are there, and they... It's not so much that you feel that they influence your behaviour, it's that they take up so much time, because you've got to prove that this is wrong, and you've got to make sure other newspapers don't do it and the television stories don't appear on it. And it does become a distraction. And I think people forget that the way some of the press behaved makes life very, very difficult, not because they've got something that is important that they're saying, but because... It is all-consuming to have to deal with their critique and their in some cases their untruths.
Yes, I mean, as an actor, you're encouraged not to read your reviews, because it doesn't help you to go.
Oh, I stopped reading them a long time.
Yeah, but presumably
I didn't even read the good ones, because
well, no, they don't help either.
No, they don't.
Yes, but presumably
I bet yours have been very good.
No, not all the time. Yeah, I can quote some bad ones that I should never have read back at you. I mean, and the press were at times, as you've been recounting, vicious and often just plainly untrue.
But of course, it's when they find something that they know is acutely personal and can really, you know, people can remember, because you know, I remember there was a letter I wrote to the mother of a deceased soldier, and I'd written this letter in good faith. You know, there were so many letters that we were writing at that time because we were losing a lot of men in Afghanistan. And they claimed that I had misspelled names, and they claimed all this. And it wasn't true. My writing's not very good. It never was very good. But to claim that was very hurtful. But also, again, it took up days of time just having to deal with this wrongful allegation. And then I phoned the mother who had complained and gone to the Sun and got them to do this story. And then the Sun taped my phone call, and then they published it, but only those extracts that they thought suited their cause. It was very difficult. So you've got to deal with all these things, and you're dealing with a financial crisis at the same time.
Well, you know, yes.
You're having to negotiate a whole series of big changes in economic policy, not just in your country, but for Europe and for the rest of the world. And this is a huge sort of distraction at the time that you're trying to do these things.
Yeah.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
So when all that does finish, when you've been Chancellor for all these years, you've been Prime Minister during the biggest financial crisis since the 30s,
yes,
at least.
Since the 30s.
And then you come to general election 2010. There's a bit of horse trading for a few days afterwards, but you move on. And like you said,
out and on.
and as you see, it happens very quickly.
Does somebody else
come and pack your bags? Pretty, how does that work?
You know, you go to America and people say, you know, you meet Bill Clinton and say, President Clinton. And I keep saying in Britain, look, when you go, you not only lose the title, you lose the house overnight. You lose any ability to present yourself as something. So it is pretty dramatic.
Yes.
You know, in America, they have a transition period. In America, you keep the title. Everybody calls him president still. In Britain, none of that. None of that. You're out. And then you're very tired, so you sleep for a bit, and then you have to get your thoughts together.
I think I'm right in saying that immediately after you left Downing Street, you went to Scotland and Sarah stayed in London because the boys were going to school.
Yeah, I felt that the only thing to do was to get back to my constituency. You know, to hang around London was both stupid and probably counterproductive. And you had to give the new government the space, and obviously they were going to take it anyway. And you had to give the Labour Party the chance to elect the new leader because you had to go as leader as well, having lost the election. And so I went back to Scotland, and we've stayed there ever since because our kids are now at school there. And I come to London every now and then. But I do like the fact that I'm living where I was brought up and in the constituency, which I represented for more than 30 years.
But when you do... So you've just left Downing Street. Sarah's not even with you. And you wake up in your house in Concordia.
Sarah actually came back to Scotland with me and then came back down to London later.
But in those days and weeks immediately after that...
Yeah, the boys were still finishing the school.
Sure.
We didn't want to take them out of school before July. And then so they were in London. I was mainly in Scotland, but I was still a Member of Parliament.
Sure.
So I came down for debates and for
but presumably your
being signed in.
Day-to-day workload immediately sort of gets a lot lighter.
I mean, you've got to write a lot of letters to thank people.
Right.
You've still got to deal with some of the follow-through from the election, and the raising money, for example, for the election was a very difficult thing to do. And you're still a constituency member of parliament, so you want to show people that you haven't forgotten that you are their elected member with representing your hometowns.
And what about family life? Do you have to rebuild family life? Because
you've got to be reintroduced to my children.
Yes,
no.
Well, to an extent.
The good thing about Downing Street was that it's your office, but also your home.
Right.
And therefore you see your children all the time. You know, if you were away, for example, doing a film shoot or...
Sure.
You're away from your kids. Mm. And so you're staying in a hotel or something. I mean, I'm actually staying in the house that is also my office. And so your children can walk in and see you at almost any time of the day, if you know, and they can interrupt meetings in a way that's quite dramatic sometimes.
So,
I remember with General Petraeus and Ian Paisley. I remember both of these people. One of my sons is coming in and said, "Teach me how to march," to General Petraeus. And I think Ian Paisley for a different reason, but it was very very funny. But so you actually. Probably more than many other jobs, your children can be with you for some time of the day,
right?
And therefore, it's not as cut off in that sense
so
from your family.
Sort of difficult re-entry into domestic life.
They did recognise me, and they were prepared to talk to me.
Right.
And but you know, they had to move schools, so they were adjusting to that as well.
Yeah, sure. I also read that during 2009, you used one of your week's holidays to volunteer at a hospice in Fife.
Well, I kept saying to people that we needed a giving society. And I actually wrote a book after I became Prime Minister that was about community action and people giving the time to help causes that were local as well as national causes. So I've always tried to promote the charities and the voluntary organisations in my own constituency. And Sarah and I decided that we couldn't actually just talk about it, that even if you're Prime Minister and you've got a holiday or something, if you've got to give some days to do this. And so we decided that this hospice that was actually it's an amazing place in my constituency, which are the national health hospitals, which are not very many of them, but they did need volunteers. And so we agreed that for a week when we were up in Scotland on holiday, we'd go in the morning and afternoon, and we would help the hospice do a number of things that they were trying to do. They were trying to create a library, for example. They were trying to do some other sort of repairs and so on. I was useless at repairs, but I could move books around and things like that.
So
you met the patients.
So you were humping boxes of books around and you were...
Things like that. But
there's not many prime ministers who've done that in their whole
life. No, and we didn't tell people about it at the time.
No.
We didn't want to sort of advertise the sort of... as if you're trying to make yourself into something that you just want to publicity for. But yes, and I think it's quite good that people do these things, that you know, that you give up some of your time to help people. And actually, being in a hospice and talking to people, you know, that the patients, even though they're dying, are incredibly grateful for any help that they get. I mean, that is something that sort of almost surprised me, because I hadn't known enough about that experience, you know, maybe some are a bit angry at what's happening to them, but most are just grateful for the small amounts of help they get from people who are both volunteers and staff. And the staff, of course, do this amazing job, and you know, not of course just in the hospices, but right across the National Health Service. And you're awestruck by the amount of dedication that you see and the great service. But I do think we should encourage more people, and I try to do one or two things that advance that now, but we do need people to give more, and to give more of the time in particular. And one of the problems in Britain today is there's so many people living on their own, and there's a lot of loneliness around that needs people to sort of say to people that they've got a friend, and if you need a friend, we're there. So it, you know, it can make a difference, but you know, it's not something that you sort of it would have been wrong to have talked about it at the time.
I feel like you've been... You were given a sense of morality, I presume, from your parents and from your upbringing
I think we both learned in Scotland quite the hard way, in a sense that there are things that are expected of you, and there are things that you've really got to get used to doing, because that is what you should be doing. And it's not a childhood that is sort of dull or boring or without joy or happiness, but it's just part of your childhood that's what's expected of you, as well as all the other things that you get almost in return.
No, so I feel that humility and that moral compass absolutely defines you. Do you ever think it...
My father used the word moral compass all the time, actually.
Right.
And I think that was quite a good word to describe his influence on me. Well, two words, you know, that he was a moral compass.
Do you worry that as a politician, it might also limit you? yes. having a moral compass.
I don't know about, I thought you worried about a politician that you were. What you can't do is become. I mean, someone said there's only two types of politicians: those who looked like bishops and those who looked like bookies. You know, people who are trying to sell something and people who are trying to be holier than thou. And I don't think you can be either. I really don't think. If you try to be a bishop, people will just pull you apart. So you mustn't, you know, even if you feel strongly. I mean, for example, I felt strongly about many of the, if you like, the conscience issues, you know, and I said things about, you know, I wanted organ donor donation, and I couldn't get that through. It's now gone through thanks to Geoffrey Robinson, MP, that's got, you know, the people's organs can now be donated so that lives can be saved. I was against assisted dying. I didn't like the idea that there was a bureaucratic system for declaring yourself now wanting to be dead and asking some bureaucratic procedure to be gone through. So I had strong views on a number of big issues, but I don't really think that people expect their politicians or like their politicians to try to sort of bring, if you like, the work of a priest or a minister into being a politician. I think that's not what people expect of you. And I think if you try to do that, then you're almost certainly going to be accused of over-moralizing and being pious and holier than thou. And I don't think that's a good thing.
I think there's perhaps something of an advantage now. Almost 10 years after you were in Downing Street, I think you're now regarded as an elder statesman. I think you're now looked to for wisdom.
That just makes you feel old.
Because of your experience. And I think people crave a bit of wisdom.
There are some there's some evidence that wisdom does not grow with age, but yeah, I mean, people sometimes ask your opinion on things, but in the end, you know, I think you've just got to accept that that you're out now, and that you can't sort of try and rerun the past. You've got to accept what happened, and if you can make an intervention that can make a difference. I spoke up very strongly against anti-Semitism when there was a problem and has been a problem in the Labour Party. I'm very angry about universal credit, about the way that children are being pushed into poverty, the numbers of children in poverty, 3 million now, 4 million, rising to 5 million in Britain. It's outrageous. We've got to do something about it. And obviously I'm unhappy about Brexit, and I feel that if we could only reopen this debate in a way that listened to people who were Leave voters and understood the concerns, we could persuade them that being in Europe was not actually, or being out of Europe was not actually the real issue that has to be dealt with. There are many other issues.
So, just to finish, can I ask, the elder statesman that you now are we going to be okay? As a nation, as we look into the distance at all the craziness that seems to be hurtling towards us.
That sounds...
Are you an optimist?
Are we going to be
heart?
Okay? Sounds like a question that's put to a priest, isn't it? I'm an optimist at heart because I actually believe in young people. I believe in people's capacity for renewal. I believe in people's willingness in the end to look at questions on the merits and not just be guided by prejudice, but it does take time and it does take work and it does take you know, getting out there into the country, you know. And I think one of the problems at the moment is that people out there in the country feel very distant from the people who are sitting in Whitehall and Westminster. They feel that nobody has listened to them. They feel that people many of our leaders are out of touch, and I think it's really incumbent on anybody who is in public life or in the public arena to actually listen more, to have a conversation more with people in the country. And if they did so, I think I see, for example, on immigration, I've always thought if you actually explain to people the things that you could do to manage migration, you could win people round. I've always believed that when you come to this issue of take-back control, sovereignty, if you actually explain that the German, the French, the Belgium, the Italian courts, they're standing up to the European Court of Justice just as we could. I mean, I think when you can actually get information across to people and you can have a dialogue with people and a conversation and treat people with respect, you can actually win arguments that seem to be beyond us. And at the moment, yes, you are right. We're an incredibly divided country. I wrote an article a few days ago for The Mirror when they asked me to do so, saying I thought we were more divided than during the three-day week in the 70s, the miners' strike in the 80s, the poll tax in the early 90s, the Iraq in the beginning of the century. And it really is sad if these divisions are going to continue and the polarization is going to continue, because what's actually happening is that people are accusing each other of betrayal. You know, it becomes a poisonous and toxic debate. So I think everybody who's in public life have got to make an effort to both to listen to people and to see what can actually bring us together again, because Britain is more than a collection of Remain and Leave voters. Britain is actually people who have shared values and they've got mutual interests and they've got common goals, and we've got to find a way of bringing people together again.
Gordon, thank you very much.
David Tennant Does a Podcast With is a Something Else and No Mystery production. Produced and edited by James Deacon. Additional production from Chris Skinner, Steve Ackerman, Sarah Camlett, Josh Gibbs, Joel Freeman, and Georgia Tennant. Next time.
David, I can't believe you're interviewing me. This is so weird. I'm in my pajamas. This was so past my bedtime. I'm having vodka for the love of Pete. She's a wheeze.
Also from Something Else.
Katy Piper's Extraordinary People. Join Katy for a series of powerful and inspirational conversations with people who have triumphed over adversity. With guests including Fern Cotton.
And what about when you get really lazy journalism? So like people that draw just one line, they take it out of context. And that's really sad because...
It is. It is. And I've also been on the receiving end of it so many times. Sometimes to really tragic levels for me where I've really not felt able to cope with it.
Yeah.
Zoe Sugg and Nadia Hussein. I think the thing with women, firstly, is that women sometimes don't always... like to see other women succeed.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of that, and I think that's why it's really hard sometimes, because in the last 4 years, I've changed so much. Mm.
Listen now in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all good podcast apps.